So with that, reading then as an introduction, it's my pleasure to invite Greg to speak on his topic this evening, the U.S. presidential election and Bible prophecy. Greg. Oh, you're muted, it looks like.
Thanks very much, Matt, and hopefully you can see the overhead okay.
Yes, yeah.
Great, thank you very much. So first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for inviting us. We really appreciate it. And of course, we bring with us all the love from the Comox Valley, the far north up here, Vancouver Island, and Vicky as well. So we're really pleased to be with you tonight. We appreciate this. So we miss everybody, obviously. So we're going to be talking about a subject that's probably been on everybody's mind way too much. And probably getting really tired of it. And you'll be pretty relieved to know that we're not going to be discussing at great length Donald Trump or Joe Biden. So that may give everybody a big sigh of relief. But we do want to talk a little bit about the United States and how they got to the place that they're in now and what the future may look like, because I think that's quite important. There is a lot of unrest and chaos, particularly in the U.S. right now. And I think because there's so much chaos in the United States, there's a lot of unrest throughout the world, not knowing what's going to happen. I don't think there's ever been a time in the last century when every single country in the world has been affected like it has now. They're reeling from a global pandemic and the implications of economy, the downturn in economies and that sort of thing. And I think the big concern about the instability of the U.S. is destabilizing lots of world powers. And it's enabling people like Putin of Russia, who have actually been hoping and actively influencing this kind of stability. So we see this sort of thing played out in the reading that Matt gave us tonight, which I really appreciated. From Luke chapter 21, see it on the screen here. Luke 21 and verses 25 to 26. That there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity. The sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Now, it'd be easy to say that there's been lots of chaos and tumult over the last century. World War I for sure, World War II for sure, but I don't think there's been any event in that time frame that has affected every single nation on earth in the way that this last year has, the year 2020. And when you compound that with what's going on in the United States right now, tending to destabilize things, it's really causing people to fear upon what's going on the earth. Now, there's no question that presidential elections in the U.S. are always interesting and they're often entertaining. And I would have said that normally that would be the case here, but this goes way beyond entertaining. In fact, most people are very fearful about what's happening, particularly when you see Donald Trump encouraging unrest and even tending towards outright rebellion and possibly even civil war, that it is really causing people to be concerned and starting to fear significantly. Now, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have messages, their prospective parties have messages that they're trying to get across. The message of Joe Biden, of course, and the Democrats, they've been saying that over and over again. They want unity, they want compassion and respect back in government again. On the other hand, Donald Trump and the Republican Party seem to be being very inclusive and focusing on this idea of let's make America great again, as if it hasn't been great and it needs to have a significant change. And you get these two competing opinions. And the angst between the Democrats and Republicans has always been difficult, for sure. but I don't think it's been as volatile as this in the last several decades. And certainly there's this desire to win the election. And of course, it looks like somebody has won the election. The Democrats were seeking for this idea of inclusion and love. The Republicans, and specifically Trump, are calling for exclusion. They want to build walls and that sort of thing. And Trump's been pretty successful at gathering support for that kind of thinking. In the 2016 election, Trump won a very decisive electoral college win, even while losing the popular vote. And the surprise of the Democrats when Hillary Clinton actually lost was pretty amazing. And so they've been reeling from that for 4 years. The country now has been living under the leadership of someone who appears to rule to satisfy his base only and his own sort of narcissistic bent. And of course, you could debate at length the impact his presidency will have upon the U.S. over the next few years. Apparently, though, much to his surprise and to a lot of people's surprise, he lost the current election. He's both lost the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. And Joe Biden, of course, has been declared the president-elect by most news organizations. That, of course, isn't going to be the case officially until it's certified in mid-December. Meanwhile, as you see day by day, and if you watch the news, it's almost a tragedy more than anything. Trump continues to cling to power by declaring the election a fraud and that his second term has been stolen from him. And he continues to fire up his base in doing it. There's lots of things we could say about it, but I think this quote from The Guardian tells a lot of the story that we're reading right now. The fog of political war is clear. It's plain that Joe Biden scored a truly remarkable victory in the U.S. presidential election. It's never easy to dislodge a sitting president. It's been very hard. Bill Clinton was the last challenger to pull it off in 1992, when the incumbent is as unscrupulous as Donald Trump. Defeating him requires a very special skill set. Yet Biden managed it with votes to spare. Despite jitters over early unfavorable results, inaccurate opinion polls, and Trump's premature declaration, Biden has won the Electoral College by a solid margin and beat his rival by more than 5 million votes, 50.9% to 47.3%. He conquered key Midwest states, lost in 2016, and it was confirmed on Friday he managed to flip Georgia and Arizona, which is quite significant, so we understand. So he's going to continue to fight these election results right until the bitter end. And beyond all the fact that his party are not really acquiescing to the fact that Biden won the election, a few are. The nation itself is unique when you look at it. The fact that they have this idea of democracy, they're the bastions of democracy for 250 plus years. And yet they are quite unique, and we want to try and fathom a little bit about what makes them unique, I think, just so we have this, the idea of the context of where we're at. They've been a democracy for, as we said, more than 250 years. Issues that were important in its early years when they were just being formed as a country are still big today. It's always been big government versus small government, individual rights versus group rights, free markets versus controlled trade, and connection with the world versus focusing on internal affairs. Those things that they fought the British government against in the 1700s are things they still believe in strongly. Without a doubt, the United States exerts probably the most significant influence in the world. They have a massive technologically advanced military for which they spend a staggering amount of money. But when we look at these things as Christadelphians, we always approach subjects like the United States and where they are at politically on one fundamental assumption. We don't just look at what's happening in the politics and today's news items, that sort of thing. We're always looking at what the Bible has to say in regards to what's happening in the kingdom of man. In Isaiah 45, it says, God formed the earth and made it. He established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. As he says, I am the Lord and there is none else. We think it's logical to assert that if there is a great designer and if he has created human beings to inherit the planet, no other, then there must have been an ultimate objection, objective in his mind rather. And so happily, we haven't been left to guess about these things because we have our Bibles in front of us. From the day that God put a human being on the earth, Adam and Eve, his one supreme purpose was that his creation should willingly respond to his own perfection. It says in the prophecy of Habakkuk chapter 2, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now we don't see that today, but we believe that God is continuing to work out his plan and purpose for the earth, and that will be the ultimate objective. The final stage in fulfilling that intention is what the Bible describes as the kingdom of God on earth. And so that's our understanding. And we want to have a brief look at U.S. history to date to see what the future might hold for them, as well as the rest of the nations upon the earth, because they obviously are important. And we want to try and fathom beyond the current chaos what the future holds. Do we need to be fearing? Do we need to be worrying about these things? Or is there a hope beyond today? Now, if you look at the history of the United States, it's lengthy, it's complex, it's incredibly interesting. We're just going to go over it very briefly, but we want to look at it particularly from the point of view of what God may be looking at it as. As we know, in the early 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, European nations came to the Americas looking for wealth, looking for resources, looking to broaden their influence over world affairs. And of course, the Spanish were front and center among them at the time to explore the new world and the first to settle in the Americas. And of course, you have a sort of a depiction there of Christopher Columbus claiming the land of the Americas. And after the discovery in 1492, it took almost another century and a half until the settlement from Europe began in real earnest. And during that time, England started to build up several colonies in this new land. They could see the opportunity and the impact of the incredible resources that this new land had. It was vast and it was untamed, but it was incredibly rich. And they could see the potential for a great wealth there. And so in 1690, the first slaves were brought to Virginia, having been ordered for the tobacco industry, which was a big industry, for the first 200 or 300 years. By 1620, the Pilgrims landed near Cape Cod after they emigrated from England and the Netherlands, and they founded the Plymouth Plantation. And on their ship, the Mayflower, which all kids learn about, they signed an agreement which says that the government and laws should follow them and help with their common decision without giving up loyalty to the British crown. And so after several new colonies were founded in America, it was called New England by the Pilgrims. And so again, you have kind of a depiction of the early settlers to the American colonies. 1650, England established a dominant presence on the whole of the Atlantic coast. The first colony was founded at Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. Many of the Europeans who settled in the New World came to escape religious persecution. They were looking to get a new start. In both Virginia and Massachusetts, the colonists flourished with some assistance from the Native Americans, and hence they still celebrate those early allegiances with Thanksgiving, which is going on this week, I think, in the United States. Theirs is a month after ours in Canada. The New World grains such as corn kept the colonists from starving, Well, in Virginia, tobacco provided this huge, valuable cash crop, which was introduced to Europe very early on. And by the early 1700s, enslaved Africans made up a growing population of the colonial population. By 1770, more than 2 million people lived and worked in Great Britain's 13 American colonies. That's kind of what the map looks like in the early 1770s. You can see it was largely colonized all the way down to the tip of Florida. In fact, there was even colonies in Florida at the time. So by the 1770s, Great Britain had established a number of colonies, and 13 of them was the first group of them as they're getting established. Under the rule of King George III, they were tied to Britain through trade, even though they were a flourishing colony, and they were established up and down the east coast of North America. They were still tied through trade, and were governed by the British government. Trade was restricted to the colonies, and they had to rely on Britain for any imported goods and supplies. Of course, in those days, there was no banks, and there was very little actual money. So the colonists used barter or credit to get the things they needed. And following the French and Indian War, Britain wanted to control expansion into the Western territories, so beyond the Appalachian Mountains. But the king issued the proclamation of 1763 prohibiting settlements beyond the Appalachian Mountains, at least not without the control of the British army to make sure that the king's rule would continue to be established. And so there was actually a proclamation of 1763, which ensured that colonists would not settle to the west of the Appalachian Mountains. But unfortunately, colonists had already settled east of, or west of those mountains, and they were ordered to return back to the other side of the mountains towards the east coast again. In 1765, Parliament passed the Quartering Act that said that the colonists needed to fine or pay for lodging for British soldiers stationed in America. It's not like today when the government funds the army to be moved from place to place. If they're going to do some sort of if they're going to be moving troops into Afghanistan or something like that, the central government pays for it all. In those days, the king and the government wanted the colonists to pay for the British soldiers that were stationed in America. And with the French and Indian War over, a lot of colonists didn't see any need for the soldiers to be stationed in the colonies. Britain also needed money to pay for its war debts because they were heavily in debt at the time. So the king and parliament believed they had the right to begin taxing the colonies in earnest. And so they decided to require several kinds of taxes from the colonists to help pay for the French and Indian War. And those included the Stamp Act in 1765, which required the use of paper that was generated in Britain, special paper, bearing an embossed tax stamp for all legal documents. So no legal document could be initiated without this special paper. And of course, they were expensive. Other laws, such as the Townshend Act, passed in 1767, required the colonists to pay for taxes on imported goods, specifically tea. And many colonists felt that they should not pay for these taxes, as they were passed in England by the Parliament, not by their own colonial governments. And so they protested, saying that these taxes violated their rights as British citizens. So they started to resist, and they started to boycott. They started to not purchase goods and started to rely more and more on the things they produced in the colonies. And in 1773, some colonists in Boston, Massachusetts, demonstrated their frustration by dressing up like Indians, sneaking onto ships in the Boston Harbor, and dumping the tea that had been imported from Britain into the water, into the bay, which was known as the Boston Tea Party. And the British took action by closing the Boston port. A similar but smaller Tea Party took place in Yorktown, Virginia in 1774. So there's a lot of tension and unrest, and there's people are starting to consider rebellion against this government that was literally an ocean away and felt that they were being mistreated. And so the First Continental Congress met in 1774 to make a list of complaints about the way the British were treating the colonies. Many people in America felt their concerns were not being heard, and this caused more unhappiness. It was really the beginnings of open rebellion against the king and the parliament. And so in April of 1775, a group of colonists fought against the British army in two battles, the Battle of Lexington and the Battle of Concord. And in 1775, the Second Continental Congress decided to form their own militia, their own army, which consisted of citizens from all 13 colonies. And it turns out that George Washington was selected to be the commander-in-chief of this new colonial army, and he organized the rebellion into a full-fledged army instead of just an uprising. So a peace petition was sent to the British king, and it was rejected, and Washington proclaimed a proclamation of open rebellion. Thomas Jefferson, well known to even those of us in Canada, begins to prepare something he called the Declaration of Independence, which was first published in 1776. The Continental Congress in 1774 with George Washington speaking. There was lots of battles against Britain. And the War of Independence for these 13 colonies against British rule turns to victory in Saratoga in New York. And although the British did win battles during the period of 1778 to 1780, the colonists continued to fight them until they fought them in Yorktown with the help of the French, who intervened, who were not friendly with the British. And the British finally had to capitulate. And so the war was won for the American colonists, and they defeated King George III, and he had to acknowledge a peace contract with them. He can no longer rule across an ocean, this large population that had become rebellious on the Americas. So what is known as Canada, of course, as we know from our own history, remained loyal to Britain and King George, and the American colonies were declared as the United States of America in 1787. And there was a convent of constitution that they came together in Philadelphia to pen the first written constitution. And at that time, George Washington becomes the first president of the Union of the 13 colonies, the United States or United Colonies of America. And this was a different government than had existed before. Most of them were governments consisting of kings and dictators and oligarchs, that sort of thing. This was a new system, a relatively new system of government called a presidential republic. And it began with George Washington as the first president of the U.S. It's based on division of powers, as we know, where the Congress creates legislation and consists of a House of Representatives and a Senate. It has to decide about peace and war, military, contracts with other states, coins, weights, duties, and taxes. The second arm of this presidential republic is the executive branch. The president is the chief executive of the executive branch, and he has to select the civil servants and takes care of the execution of the decisions that Congress makes. The third part of this presidential republic is the judiciary. That's the Supreme Court, essentially, which is given power to watch over the law and the Constitution to make sure that the Constitution is maintained. And then this year also, when this was all established in 1789, the Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution, which guaranteed basic rights such as liberty, equality, and justice. And so there's an actual photograph of the original Constitution of the United States. And that was penned in 1787. Of course, we all know the history of the U.S., including their expansion across the South and West Louisiana territories, previously owned by France, which they won. The War of 1812 against Britain or Canada, which they lost. The Mexican-American War in 1846, where they started to gain more territory in the South, Texas and those areas. And then, of course, the huge dichotomy that existed in the middle of the 19th century, 1861 to 1865, the American Civil War, where we saw at the end of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln in 1865. After that, the Spanish-American War in 1898 and on into the 20th century, World War I and World War II. So after all of that, this tumultuous sort of progress and dichotomy that's always existed between largely the North and the South, and the ideals that they stood for since the original 13 colonies, a lot has happened in the United States. But a lot of the same issues that they started with persist until today. So you wonder, with a nation that's that big, 350 million people, that has that much influence throughout the world, what place, if any, do they have in Bible prophecy? So all of this is really fascinating, especially when we see the things that are going on in the United States right now. Not only are they, like all countries, battling a pandemic and losing, it seems, they're fighting a war of which they're losing, there's also more chaos and more of this feeling of us and them in the United States than there has been since the middle of the 1800s, when the first Civil War started. So we're not going to go into that in great deal, just to know that it's obviously important. All of these events and circumstances are obviously important. To understand it, we'd have to spend a lot of time in Daniel, specifically chapter 2, and Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. These prophecies that are outlined in detail, and I'm absolutely certain you've listened to lots of talks on Daniel 2 and Ezekiel, these prophecies define history throughout the ages, which is what's really significant, and specifically name kingdoms and nations leading up to the return of the Lord Jesus Christ, and they're often called latter-day prophecies. So without going over all the information contained in Ezekiel 38, we just want to look at a couple of references just to see where all of this is going to. And there's definitely a focus on what God is doing, which is what's really key. The Bible tells us where God's focus is and what God is doing and what God is leading up to ultimately. And just taking a couple of verses out of context, unfortunately, but reading Ezekiel 38, verse 8, after many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years, which is a key phrase, thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have always been waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. And in verse 16, and thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the lands. It shall be in the latter days. So the key phrase there, obviously, is in the latter days. And it's against my people Israel. So that's really key. And clearly the subject of the vision is the same as described in Daniel chapter 2, when God would intervene in the kingdom and the affairs of men. And we're really left in no doubt, as God describes his fury against those nations that invade the land of Israel. Because he says it in verses 18 to 20 of Ezekiel 38. He says, "And it shall come to pass at that time when Gog, who we'll try and define in a few minutes, shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come up in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. And the mountains shall be thrown down and the steep places shall fall and every wall shall fall to the ground." I think the significant thing about these verses is this is a global, the impact of this is global. It's not isolated to the land of Israel. It says that all men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. So we can see that in effect, God has the power to achieve these sorts of things. Right now, I don't think anybody would have believed at the end of 2019, or anybody would have foreseen that we would be have been so afflicted by a global pandemic that would affect every nation on the planet. I don't think many people even thought it was possible, except for scientists who understand these sorts of things. It's hit us, it's hit the planet in such a way that is not seen since the Spanish flu at the beginning of the 1900s. It has been a global catastrophe that still continues to persist. And now we're in the second wave of the pandemic, which is continuing to hit us again. And it's affecting everything on this planet. So the fact that God can affect the entire planet in such a way is absolutely believable now, especially when you see what's happening right now. So Ezekiel and Daniel are both talking about the focus of God upon the land of Israel. And we're not going into the details of how these prophecies work out or how all of this has come about, but we do know from reading our Bibles and from reading these and other prophecies that there will be a nation called Israel. And there is a nation called Israel. Even in the time of Judah, Jesus rather, the land was known as Judea and even Israel at that time. And even though the people were scattered since AD 70 amongst the nations, nobody, I don't think, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, specifically up into World War II, would have believed that the Jews would be back in their land again, their natural land, and established a country again. And in 1948, the land of Israel became a reality. The people in Israel are described here as being brought back from the sword. And it's well known that the major impetus for the return of Jews was the Holocaust, the rule of the Nazis under Hitler in World War II. 6 million were perished, but many of them fled Europe and immediately went to the only place that they could go, short of countries like Canada and the US and Britain, back to Israel again, where they formed the foundation of a new nation. The land was described as having been waste, and that indicates two things. First, that prior to the return to the land, it wasn't productive. It was a wilderness. And secondly, that once they returned, they would bring the land back to productivity. Now, that's the miracle of Israel, in that it's not only productive, they haven't only turned a barren land into a productive one. So great has been the success of the Israelis that they're now exporting their dry land farming techniques to other countries. So again, a prophecy fulfilled. The people would be brought forth out of the nations. The actual count of the number of nations from which the Jews have returned from exceeds 150 now, with such diversity of cultures that Israel is one of the most multicultural nations on earth. And yet, even though it's called almost a multicultural nation, the amazing thing is that the Jews have come back with their original language, speaking Hebrew. They even have their own monetary system, the shekel, that existed thousands of years ago. They are one of the most unique people on earth because not only have they maintained their language, their monetary system, but their culture, their heritage, and their religion. And they continue to exist as a people where other nations like the Babylonians, the Persians, have fallen into history as being non-existent in this day and age. So they are a very unique people, but not just unique because they have survived, but because God said that they would survive. In verses 8 and 11, Israel is described as dwelling safely. And the Hebrew has more the idea of securely, confidently. And there are troubles in Israel, certainly troubles, but the people dwell as a nation securely and confidently, as they see no viable threat from the nations around them. And any threats that they have, they've largely been able to overcome. And so all of these prophecies have and are being fulfilled. And so it's worth noting, too, some of the recent events that have occurred. At no time in history prior to the creation of the modern state of Israel have these conditions been met as they have since. And consequently, because we know that these prophecies haven't been met until our day and age, we know that the fulfillment of the prophecies and everything around them is going to happen in our time period. So it talks about an aggressor who comes from the north in Ezekiel 38, who will go against the nation of Israel. And we won't get into the proof of these nations, but the nations who come from the north can be identified in the following chart. These are the aggressors, described as Rosh, equated with Russia, Meshech, Moscow, Tubal, Tobolsky, Gomer, France, Magog, Germany. And if you break it all down, this Northern Confederacy, as it's called, is composed mostly of the European Union allied with Russia. They're going to head south and attack Israel. Now, if we believe that all these other prophecies have been fulfilled, the nation of Israel being established in our time frame, establishing themselves and flourishing and dwelling safely, then we have to believe that the rest of the prophecy is going to be fulfilled. And so we see them heading south and attacking Israel. What we don't see in this confederacy is any indication of who opposes them until we read through Ezekiel 38 a bit further. And it says that in verse 13 of Ezekiel 38, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, have you come to take a spoil? Have you gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, and to take a great spoil? So there's another confederacy called Tarshish and the Young Lions who oppose the invasion of the nation of Israel. And although we don't have time to go into the detail, we believe that Tarshish can be identified as Britain primarily. And the Young Lions are those nations which are outlined in this poster for the most part. How ironic that Britain would produce a poster for World War I that's entitled The Empire Needs Men. Australia, Canada, India, and New Zealand all answer the call, helped by the Young Lions. The old lion defies his foes, enlist now. And that's a recruitment poster in 1915. And that British recruiting poster used the symbol of the British lion to appeal to other members of the empire, including Australia, Canada, India, and New Zealand, to support the cause. So that's significant. In Ezekiel 38, the young lions are of Tarshish, it says. To identify the young lions, you need to identify the countries which in some way have been reared by Britain. And the depiction of these countries as, to quote the poster, young lions, provides pretty clear evidence for relating the countries of the British Empire to the young lions of Ezekiel 38. Of course, for this link to be made, the young lions do not necessarily have to be part of an empire, but they have to come out of the empire. The key thing to this origin is they are of Tarshish. And today the British Empire no longer exists like it did in World War I, but the young lions still have a connection, a strong connection with Britain. It's seen in the Commonwealth of Nations, usually referred to as the Commonwealth. And as that sort of writing on the left says, the Commonwealth has its beginnings prior to the end of the British Empire. It was to provide a means by which the relationship between Britain and its former colonies could be maintained, albeit with countries now having autonomy and independence, specifically Australia and Canada and New Zealand, etc. The organization is intended to provide a forum for cooperation and consultation. Right now, the Commonwealth, as it sits, currently has 53 member countries, covers 1.8 billion citizens and 30% of the world's population. And it continues to provide a tangible link between the old lion and the young lions. And so the question that is debated quite a bit is whether the United States qualifies as a young lion and would be confederate with the question asked in Ezekiel, have you come to take a spoil? Is the United States a young lion? Although this point could be disputed because they did rebel against Britain and the crown over 250 years ago, many do believe that the United States continues as a young lion because of their establishment through Britain. And although I don't think many of us could possibly agree with President Donald Trump and his personality and his character and things like that, the one thing you can say for him and his administration is they have been a strong ally with Israel, who's God's chosen people. So some of the things that's happened in the last 4 years, which are definitely worth noting, is as soon as Trump became president, he was quick to establish a closer relationship with Israel. Early on, right after his inauguration in January and in February of 2016, he continued to reiterate support for Israel and her territories. He sent a message to the UN right away that the U.S. would no longer tolerate Israel being singled out for condemnation, because it seems like no matter what happens, Israel is usually the target, particularly when it concerns the Palestinians. He recognized in 2017 Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He's denounced Iran and her threats against Israel and the previous nuclear deal. He wanted to disarm Iran so that they could not attack Israel because they're in proximity. He's arranged several meetings between himself and Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. And in 2019, he declared support for Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He's increased military aid to Israel to almost $4 billion as of late 2019. And probably the most significant thing, aside from all those things, is the United States administration in the last 4 years has helped broker a peaceful accord between, first of all, Israel and the United Arab Emirates, along with other Arab nations, which actually is extending the idea of them dwelling safely in their own land. There's now flights back and forth between the UAE and Israel at this time, which is astounding. Nobody thought that was possible, even as much as 5 years ago. Saying all of that, is it important as to who gets into power in the coming presidential election? So as far as we're concerned, it's really difficult for us to look at the U.S. presidential election and determine whether Joe Biden should be the best president or whether Donald Trump should be the best president. Really, the only thing we can do when it comes to situations like this, specifically elections that are as important to the entire world as this one, is to understand who really has the power when it comes to these things. Should we worry about whether it's Joe Biden or whether it's Donald Trump? That's the question that's on lots of people's minds right now. A lot of people are elated that Joe Biden has won the election. What's really interesting, I think, is what does God think? And who does God feel needs to be in power to bring about his plan and purpose for the earth? One commentator I watched the other night called the current sort of drama that's going on in the U.S. is theater. And that's the way a lot of countries are seeing this U.S. presidential election right now, as theater almost. A comedy of errors in a way. Initially, I indicated that I might have an answer regarding our original statement, the U.S. presidential elections and Bible prophecy. Ultimately, the most important takeaway from what we're saying tonight is that we don't know absolutely every detail, the minutia of God's plan as he's working it out in the kingdom of man to bring about his purpose. What we do know, though, is the clear things that he has said, the return of Israel back to the land, the fact that they will be dwelling safely, the fact that there will be a northern confederacy who makes its grand move into the south and attacks Israel, and the fact that they will be opposed by another confederacy from the south, until ultimately Christ's return will see the doing away of all kingdoms of men into one glorious kingdom of God. And so whoever gets into power is there because God has put him into power. And so it's not our job, it's not our concern to participate in any of the elections or to really commiserate about why a particular leader is in power at the time, because we really don't know what their role may be in God's plan. What we do know for sure is that God is working out a plan, and he is putting these men and women into power so that his plan will be established. And ultimately, the most important thing is his kingdom is going to be established on earth, and there will be an ultimate ruler, and that'll be the Lord Jesus Christ, who will reign from Jerusalem. So that's our hope. Our hope is that God is going to fulfill his will and purpose. We don't have to worry about whether Trump is going to be the next president, whether he's going to cause a civil war, whether Biden is going to be the president and what's going to happen after that. All of those things are in the hands of God, and he continues to work out his plan and purpose in the kingdom of man. So God controls the kingdom of man. It says in Daniel 2, he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and he sets up kings. He gives wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Daniel 4, this matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, with the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will, and he sets up over it the basis of men. Jeremiah 27, I have made the earth, the man, and the beast that are upon the ground by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and I've given it to whom it seemed meet unto me. So if there's anything we can take away from this, it's that regardless of the chaos that seems to exist right now, regardless of the fact that we don't know where the pandemic is going and if there's going to be a vaccine in time, if the economy flounders and, you know, it continues to get worse and worse, ultimately, we know that regardless of all those things, God is continuing to work in the kingdom of men, and he is controlling things so that he will bring about his plan and purpose. That is ultimately what we're looking for. And of course, we see this even in the New Testament. We just want to close with the reading of Luke, where it says there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity. I think we can see that happening as we live and breathe right now. The sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of heaven shall be shaken, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. So no matter what chaos may exist on the earth at this time, we have absolute assurity from God and from the Lord Jesus Christ that the ultimate goal is to establish Christ as the King over the entire earth, and he will establish a kingdom of justice and peace and safety and righteousness for all of the earth. And so we pray that God sends him soon and begins the work of establishing his kingdom upon earth. Thank you very much.